You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, donations to places like Goodwill, St. Vinny's, and thrift stores have gone up during the pandemic, but a lot of those items are not really suitable for reuse. That's causing problems. We'll find out why and how to evaluate our stuff. Now, President Joe Biden called last week for an intelligence probe into the origins of COVID-19. That's after the Wall Street Journal reported on a U.S. intelligence report that found that three researchers at a lab in Wuhan, China, got sick enough to need hospital care in November of 2019, roughly the same time when many public health experts think the virus began circulating. The reporting is raising new questions about the possibility that the virus could have leaked from a lab in Wuhan, China. That was a theory many public health experts initially said was very unlikely. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about what we know about COVID origins and the possibility of a lab leak? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Michael Gordon is a national security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. He's the reporter who broke last week's story on the intelligence report. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, glad to be here.
I gave just the basics of this intelligence report. Flesh that out a little for us, please, about the workers at this lab.
Well, you know, for more than a year, there's been a debate about how the virus emerged in China. And in January, the State Department issued a statement on January 15th, still available on the website, that said, the U.S. government has reason to believe that several of the researchers at the lab became ill in autumn of 2019. And what I did, along with my Wall Street Journal colleagues, is I probed for what the evidentiary base or the intelligence was behind this public assertion. And what we were told is that there was an intelligence report that three researchers from China's Wuhan Institute of Virology became sick enough in November of 2019 that they sought hospital care. We don't know if they were all hospitalized, but they went to the hospital for care, according to this report. And, you know, this is circumstantial evidence. It doesn't prove that the virus emerged from the lab, but it certainly suggests that further investigation of the lab theory and of other possible origins of the virus is needed. And indeed, that's the conclusion President Biden himself came to as he announced last week.
Now, a key point here is we still don't know the origin of COVID-19. As you say, calls for more probes. One thing that does seem clear is that apart from releasing the genome of the virus that causes COVID-19, there are a lot of concerns, Michael, about China's transparency on this. Can you talk about some of those concerns?
Yeah, I mean, what part of what has elevated interest in this is China has not been transparent, to be diplomatic about it, about what about the lab, what the research at the lab, the health records of individuals at the lab. They haven't made any of that evidence available. And there's other sort of medical data that China has also not shared with the international community. For example, there was, according to WHO data, there were some 76,000 people who were ill between October and December in 2019. And China says, well, 92 of those are potential COVID cases, but they haven't shared data on this larger group. So they're sort of saying you have to take their word for it. Also, the WHO has asked for access to Wuhan blood banks to, in order to test samples and try to get a sense of whether there are antibodies indicating the presence of the virus prior to December 2019. And the Chinese authorities initially declined to do this. Then they said they would do it, but they haven't yet done it. So those are the sorts of things that have fed suspicions, not only on the part of Trump administrations, but also on the part of the some Biden administration's officials. Also, I just think I need to point out that the alternative thesis, the zoonotic thesis, that the virus leapt from a bat to a host to a human being, which had been sort of the dominant hypothesis for a while. Well, in over a year, they've not found a single animal infected with COVID-19. Now, there may be a whole variety of innocent reasons for that, but while there is no conclusive proof of the lab theory, there's no proof for the alternative theory either.
Talking to Michael Gordon, national security correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, looking at the origins of COVID-19, some of the latest information and lack of information out there on the subject. Michael, you write that, and it's no secret to anybody, I don't think, here in the U.S., the partisan divide is complicating this issue and how it's talked about. What kind of things do you see there?
Well, I think that, and I think this is unfortunate because this is just should be an empirical issue about investigating a virus. And it's very important to learn how it emerged, because if it was a lab accident, that suggests we need to know more about how to protect against lab accidents, particularly when they're manipulating virus. If it arose out of nature, it's a different set of problems. But it became a bit politicized last year when President Trump and some Republican lawmakers jumped on the lab theory. And some of the versions of the lab theory that were promoted by proponents on that side go well beyond a lab accident. They're people who assert that China might have been working on biological weapons in the lab, and that's what escaped. Well, I think now the lab theory is viewed as something perhaps more benign, but still quite serious for the World Health community, which is that China may have taken samples of the virus from a cave in southwest China, which is the only place where it's otherwise been found. They brought it to Wuhan, 1,500 kilometers away, to work on it and manipulated it in some way with the intention of trying to create a vaccine, and somehow it escaped. That's what the lab theory is now. And I do think it's significant that when President Biden in his statement indicated there was one U.S. intel element was leaning toward that theory, two were leaning against it. So it no longer quite has the same partisan flavor as the debate had earlier. And I think perhaps that's good, because at bottom, it's really just a scientific and intelligence question.
And when we say the lab theory, as you were just pointing out, there are multiple possibilities of what it could mean from a lab, anywhere from biological weapons research to, as you mentioned, augmenting gain of function research to develop vaccines to, hey, we're collecting and cataloging viruses and mishandled this natural virus in the lab. The lab theory covers a lot of ground.
Right. And since the WHO team was only there for 3 hours, they didn't develop any evidence that would point in one direction to another. And it's actually the theory that it rose naturally in nature and leaked from the lab, and also not entirely incompatible. It's possible it arose in nature and they took it to the lab to study it, but the lab is the location from which it emerged. I mean, geography plays a role here. The province where the virus was found in bats is 1,500 kilometers away in southwest China, and the Wuhan Institute of Virology is several kilometers away from where it was detected in the city. And we know more now than we knew a year ago also. I mean, the famous wet market, which was originally thought to be the point of origin, is no longer seen as such, including by the Chinese, because they found, it seems to have been, what happened there was a super spreader event, because they found cases that predated its detection in the wet market. So right now we have two competing theories, and President Biden has asked for an assessment in 90 days. The question is, are they going to be able to come up with a good, solid assessment that advances the issue without any cooperation on the part of the Chinese, because the Chinese have indicated that they pretty much don't intend to host any more international researchers on their soil to dig into this.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to wrap up with you on, Michael. What are countries like the U.S., organizations like the World Health Organization asking for China at this point to get information without having to rely on data collected by China?
Well, I mean, it's very hard to get to the bottom of this without the cooperation of the host nation. And the Biden administration's first course of action was to go to the WHO and request a further probe that would have, without even mentioning the lab theory, that's really what they were looking at. And they wanted to dig into it a little more. The head of WHO has said that the team efforts there were not sufficient. And so that's what they were hoping for. But the WHO operates pretty much by consensus. You can't force a nation to cooperate with an investigation if it doesn't want to cooperate. That's one of the limitations of the WHO. Biden tried that. Chinese indicated that they'd cooperated about as much as they intended to, and they thought there should be investigations in the U.S. Trying to deflect the pressure. Congress was insisting intel be declassified.
I think we lost Michael there. That was Michael Gordon. We were about done anyway. National security correspondent at the Wall Street Journal with us today to share his reporting about intelligence that's giving some new credibility to the idea that COVID-19 could have been leaked one way or another from a lab in Wuhan, China. Up next, we'll continue the conversation with a public health expert. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What value do you see in understanding the origins of the virus that causes COVID-19. What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about the origins of COVID-19 and new reporting that has some reconsidering the idea that the virus could possibly have leaked from a lab in Wuhan, China. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions. Dr. Patrick Remington joins us now, Professor Emeritus in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Remington, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back, Rob.
What kind of things do we need to know to understand how COVID-19 ended up in human populations?
Well, first, just listening to the interview of Michael Gordon from the Wall Street Journal, I think it just emphasizes the importance of investigative reporters really getting to the bottom of this, of scouring all the evidence, the scientific, the intelligence reports. And what he's found is that there's credible evidence for both possibilities. One possibility is that this, in effect, jumped from bats to other animals and then to humans, and that remains a possibility. But it is a possibility that it was leaked from a lab. I think he did comment about the there's little evidence that this was a bioweapon, that this was really intended to create harm worldwide. There's no supporting evidence for that. But I think he's done a real service to the country to open up this investigation and to really look at the evidence and look at the science.
What kind of things do we want to see for lab transparency? There are labs around the world that study potentially dangerous viruses. That's generally a good thing. It gives us early tools to use against them. But how do we mitigate the risks of a possible exposure?
Well, it's a great question. These laboratories have different degrees of safety, and it's important when there's any virus being studied to have the highest level of safety. And you've seen those in movies and on television where people are fully suited with a separate air exchange coming into their suits. And that needs to happen worldwide in any place where these potentially dangerous viruses are being studied. But I think the other point, Rob, is this is an interesting debate, but it's almost an academic debate because this is not an either or. Do we promote lab safety or do we do vigilance for zoonotic transmission? We need to do both. We need to have absolutely the safest labs possible. We need this kind of basic research, but we also need to be in the field doing surveillance for the possibility that viruses through other animals and can mutate and to get to humans. So both are possible. We're not debating whether neither is possible. We're saying both are possible. So we need vigilance in laboratory settings, but also in community settings through surveillance and really tracking the potential for zoonotic spread.
Can you talk about the importance of international cooperation? Because China did one big piece of transparency that, as I understand it, was key. They released the genome of the virus really early on. That gave a head start to vaccine development around the world. So I guess good on them. On the other hand, it seems like they're being very untransparent with this search for the origins of COVID-19. how important is it for countries to be able to work together?
I think it's true. It's as important for the United States as it is for China and all countries in the world not to mix science and politics. And in fact, if you look at the scientists involved, they've been very forthcoming in revealing the information that they had about the genome and also about the potential source of this infection. But politicians and elected officials get involved and are concerned how that information may reflect on their country. And we know that happens in China. We know that happens in this country. So I think it's really important for the scientific community, beginning with WHO and the CDC, to be at the forefront of this investigation. But again, a point I want to make is that whether it's a lab accident or through zoonotic spread, it really shouldn't change our vigilance in both settings. We need to be really careful that this doesn't happen in the future through a lab accident, but also we need to have really good surveillance to be able to find these cases if they do occur in the future, or I should say when they occur in the future, and intervene early so there's not the next pandemic.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, talking about the origins of COVID-19, still a lot of question marks there, and what it tells us about the future of disease prevention and treatment. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Krista is with us in Columbus. Krista, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to ask about, Krista?
I had heard that it wasn't possible for humans to get a virus from an animal unless it was injected. Is this true?
Krista, thanks for the call. Good basic question there, Dr. Remington. We get a lot of viruses from animals, right?
Well, yes and no. There are a lot of viruses that are specific to animals. Most bat viruses don't grow in humans, and so they're not a danger. So many people who study bat viruses don't have to use the highest level of safety because the virus itself only affects bats and not humans. But for some reason, this virus mutated and got a little section of the DNA, maybe a percent or a few percent of the DNA, and that allowed it to find a receptor on a human cell and use that to get into the human cell. So that mutation, and again, whether that was done experimentally in a lab or whether that was done through another animal, maybe the bat virus infected an animal that then changed that virus and allowed it to infect humans, we don't know. But the bottom line is some viruses aren't a danger to humans because they remain in animals and humans aren't a host. We worry when those viruses somehow develop the ability to infect humans because we've never seen them before. We don't have any immunity to them, and they can be really deadly. The SARS, MERS, and now SARS-CoV-2 viruses are great examples of viruses that did not originate in humans, came into humans through this zoonotic spread, and then created all these health problems.
Thanks a lot for that call, Krista. Now, with zoonotic viruses, ones that come from non-human animals to us humans, I mean, it seems like we're searching for a needle in a haystack if we're trying to pre-detect these things, right? There's zillions of viruses. Most of them aren't going to affect us. How do we spot the ones that could maybe?
Well, it depends if you're an optimist or a pessimist, or maybe a realist. An optimist would say we spread out across the world and we do careful surveillance through the CDC, but then the China CDC and every public health organization in the country, in the world. And we are vigilant about these viruses. When they first happen, we eradicate them using standard quarantine and isolation methods. And if that's not possible, we quickly develop a vaccine. But the pessimist would say that as long as animals and humans are mixing in these far reaches of the world, that we will always be at risk of seeing viruses that jump from animals to humans. And so it's not a question of if the next pandemic occurs, it's a question of when. And the more connected we are as a globe, the sooner that next pandemic is going to come.
Oh, and I didn't get to one point in Krista's question. She was wondering if the only way a virus could jump from an animal, non-human animal, to a human is by injection. There are other routes, as I understand it.
Oh, well, these are SARS viruses. The coronaviruses are respiratory viruses. And obviously, that is of great concern because of its potential to spread. So there are some viruses that spread through bloodborne transmission. They're risky, but they don't have the potential for widespread epidemics and pandemics because they're not as likely to spread from person to person than a respiratory virus would.
Krista, thanks for that call. Dr. Remington, what are you watching for as the United States intelligence agencies, the World Health Organization, try to track down the original cause, the original point of transmission from animal to human with COVID?
Well, I think it's great that the Biden administration has decided to be open for investigation. My hope is that the scientists in China will cooperate. I think we heard Michael Gordon talk about the existence of blood stored from transfusion banks, the ability to go back and do really complicated but important epidemiology to find out if this virus actually was present, not in 2020, but in 2019, and really to see if it has the origin through zoonotic spread. Again, that's an important scientific question, but the practical, the policy recommendation shouldn't change. We should do both, regardless of what we find. If we ever find the source of this pandemic, we're not going to change the recommendation to have high security for biosafety labs, but also to have worldwide vigilance for the possibility or for the real potential that that viruses will continue to jump from animals to humans and cause disease in the future.
Dr. Remington, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for being here, Rob.
That's Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, with us today to talk about the evolution of the theories about origins of the COVID-19 virus. We also heard from Michael Gordon with the Wall Street Journal looking at the latest international intelligence on that question. Coming up, are you wondering whether you can donate that lamp or a pair of jeans to a resale shop? Our guest says there are some things you should be aware of. You could join in also with your questions. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, more than half of all U.S. adults are fully vaccinated, and new COVID cases have dropped almost 50% over the last 2 weeks. But the rest of the world isn't out of the woods yet. On 1A's monthly vaccine Q&A, Jen White will widen the lens and go international. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about a veteran whose world opened up after joining the military.
Lori McNeil Saylor of Kenosha knew before she graduated high school that she wanted to see the world. She was ready for something different, for new experiences outside of her childhood home in Alabama. So she joined the Navy, traveled the globe, and made lifelong friends from many cultures along the way. Saylor's daughter, Erica Saylor, interviewed her about her experiences as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices initiative.
My name is Lori McNeil Saylor. I am 59. I am also located in Kenosha, Wisconsin. I was originally born in Kalamazoo, Michigan. I moved to Mobile, Alabama after my mom passed. I was 4. And this wonderful woman named Alice adopted me. She already had 4 kids, so my siblings. We grew up outside a lot, playing together, running around barefoot, just doing kid stuff. When did you enlist? I wanted to be somewhere other than Alabama. My thought process was I didn't want to go into 13th grade, as I put it, because I didn't want to go to school with the same people that I went to high school with. I wasn't really comfortable with a lot of those people. Mm-hmm. I was a lot shyer then. So when they came to the school, it sounded interesting and I signed up.
What was basic training like?
You know, it was so different because now you're living with people from all over the country. I think that's where my interest in learning about other people came from, because there were, like I said, people from different cultures. And I remember this one young lady, she was just this tiny little curly haired blonde. And she asked me, "Can I touch your hair?" And I looked at her and I was just like, "Sure." And afterwards she said, "Why is your hair different from mine?" And I said, because that's the way God made it. And she was like, oh, it was so easy for her to understand that.
Is there someone that you served with you remember fondly?
My two most favorites are your Aunt Flo and your Aunt Trina, because I met one on the bus and the other one in boot camp. And we've been friends for over 30 years.
How do you think your time in the military affected you?
It opened my eyes a great deal as far as education, how to save money, just things that I hadn't really learned yet. You know, it gave me a lot of opportunities, you know, semi-free education, traveling. It definitely opened up my world and gave me the travel bug. That's the one thing I think is probably one of the most awesome things that the military did for me. I was there when they first put women on board ships. I was there when the Cold War ended, when Russia came to Norfolk, Virginia. I got to see that, you know, and I think I still have a Coke bottle with the Russian writing on it. So there are things that I got to see and experience that a lot of people don't get to do. So,
and you never would have.
Right. So I'm very grateful for the things that I was able to accomplish in the military.
Do you have any advice for someone who is interested in joining?
I believe traveling, learning about other cultures, it's probably the best thing that you can do for your own sense of being. It helps you open up your mind and your eyes, and you get to learn so much. So definitely education, travel. And I always tell them, find someone you want to emulate when you first join. Find someone that you would like to be like, and you follow them around. You ask them questions. You learn from them. You know, just absorb it all. Make it worthwhile.
Right.
So I wish someone had told me that when I was joining, but I figured it out on my own.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did. Yes, you did.
That was Lori McNeil Saylor of Kenosha, Wisconsin. She shared her experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
Now, as people were stuck at home a lot during the pandemic, many took the opportunity to clean out some stuff. That includes donating things like furniture, toys, and clothes to thrift stores. Those places say they welcome the giveaways and are encouraging others to do the same. But here's the thing. While the vast majority of items donated are just fine, a lot of the rest is either defective or worn out and can't be reused. It is a problem because donation centers get stuck having to deal with all of those things. That takes time, staffing, and money away from other priorities. So they're trying to educate people on what they can and can't accept. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been donating more stuff lately? Did you do a big cleanup and purge of stuff at home? How do you decide whether to give or throw something away? Do you shop at thrift stores? If you work or volunteer at a donation center, what kind of things have you seen? And do you have questions about what can and should be donated? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Johnson is the communications coordinator for Goodwill of South Central Wisconsin. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thank you for having me.
Have you seen a jump in donations, this house cleaning urge that maybe people have had over the course of the pandemic?
Well, like you had mentioned, you know, like other organizations similar to ours, we did see an influx of donations during the pandemic. You know, during the shutdown, people were home. They were cleaning out their attics, their closets, their basements and garages, so all the areas that they wanted to do prior to the pandemic, but maybe they just didn't have the time. But those donations were much larger in volume than average. And despite the big clean out this time last year, we still have seen a steady growth in donations at nearly every location this year.
Before we get into the do's and don'ts of donations, one point that you and other organizations have made in general is, yeah, you want donations, right? That's part of what keeps things flowing.
Right. Yes, we do want donations. We value every donation that we receive. You know, every donation that we get has a story behind it. whether it's a celebration or a wedding, or maybe it's, you know, grandma's old china. So when you donate, you're giving those items a second life, and you're also keeping them out of the local landfill. So it's really a win-win for everyone. You're doing something good for the planet while you're cleaning out those donations. So we welcome and appreciate all the generous donations that we receive.
And can you let us know, for a Goodwill, a nonprofit, what kind of things do you end up doing with the money that you make when you sell that stuff?
Well, our, like, we sort and we sell the best of what is donated through our 13 retail stores and our online e-commerce site, shopgoodwillmadison.com. And the items that are not sold in our stores are responsibly recycled. And they go to make things like carpet pads that are sent through the recycling stream. We also partner with Dell Reconnect. It's a computer recycling program. So if you have something like a hard drive, a desktop, printer, cables, things like that, we can take those things and recycle them responsibly. So again, it's all about keeping those things out of the local landfill. So you're doing good for the planet. You know, we just celebrated Earth Day back in April. So at Goodwill, you know, even though Earth Day is in April, every day is Earth Day for us.
Now, that's the good stuff. I have seen reporting that, you know, sometimes people bring in the stuff, maybe through good intentions or whatever, that you can't use. What kind of things should people not be bringing to your drop-off sites?
Well, you know, when you think about what you're going to donate, you know, ask yourself this question. Would you pass this along to a family friend, or, you know, a family member or a friend? Or would you sell it at a garage sale? If the answer is yes, then, you know, you definitely want to consider donating those things. You know, we take special care of all of our donations. And we, you know, like, for instance, we receive lots of flags as donations. So we've donated all those flags to the VSW to make sure that they are properly donated. We recently received some Indian artifacts that we turned over to the Ho-Chunk community, and some exotic furs that we we turned over to the Henry Vilas Zoo. So there are things that we can't, you know, accept, you know, building materials, infant furniture, large appliances, you know, tube TVs, things like that, that we can't accept. But, you know, we certainly take clothes, shoes, books, media, household items, and again, those computer items, whether they're working or not.
Now, how about the broken stuff or the clothes that's too far gone? How, in effect, if I've been on the fence, like, oh, maybe somebody else could use this. If I'm just bringing in something that I probably should throw away, and then you're throwing it away instead, I mean, how much a hassle does that create for you and your sorters?
Well, see, that's just the thing. We're not throwing it away. Those things, and before I worked for Goodwill, I had no idea that we recycled those items. You know, when you have like those pair of jeans or something, like you said, with a hole in it, and you're like, you know, I can't wear this and I can't give it to anybody. I'm just going to throw it away. Well, you don't need to throw it away. You can donate it to us. And again, we put those items through a responsible recycling stream, and they're turned into, like I said, things like carpet pads and stuff like that. So keeping it out of the local landfill, that is what it's really all about.
We're talking about the kinds of stuff we can and can't donate to Goodwill and other donation centers. David Johnson is with us, communications coordinator with Goodwill of South Central Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you done a big pandemic household cleanup? Have you donated a bunch of stuff? What kind of things did you do? Where did you take it? Do you shop at resale shops? What kind of finds have you had this year or over the years? You're looking forward to being able to get back in one of those stores. Do you work at a sorting center yourself? What kind of things do you see? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about donating stuff. Goodwill stores around the country say they're seeing a lot of donations as people use their pandemic time to clean out their homes and donate a lot of items. Goodwill and other organizations say they appreciate the generosity. There are some things, though, that you can't bring in for reuse and resale. or even recycling. David Johnson is communications coordinator with Goodwill of South Central Wisconsin. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you done the big clean out yourself? Were you able to donate a bunch of good stuff to Goodwill or other organizations? Are you looking forward to getting back to your own thrift shopping at these kind of stores? Love to hear from you also if you've sorted through donations. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, this conversation was prompted in part by some reporting from AP. One thing they heard from some stores around the country, not just here in Wisconsin, is people, as they do these cleanouts, donating things like hazardous materials that should be going, you know, to a city yard or that kind of thing. What would you say to people as they're figuring out, look at those paint cans or muriatic acid I found tucked away in my basement when I did the cleaning?
Well, I mean, we certainly can't take those items, but there are, responsible places within the communities that will be able to responsibly recycle those. And if you go to our website, goodwillscwi.org /donate, you'll see a list of our donation guidelines, as well as where you can take those paints, chemicals, and other hazardous materials.
And if we show up at the site and we're just not sure, maybe we don't have web access or we're not sure where the line is, could your Goodwill donation acceptors tell us, yeah, that will take that, not so much?
Well, if it's like a large, item like building materials, mm-hmm. things like that, that we will, let the donors know, we're thankful that you brought this in, but unfortunately we won't be able to take it. But if you're bringing in a bag of clothes or shoes or books, we're not going to look through the bag and say, oh, hey, we don't want this one or we don't want that one. No, we're not going to do that. Again, we happily accept all of the donations because, they fund our programs. We have our job support programs where we provide job coaches for individuals with mental illnesses throughout the community. We have those training programs also for our own employees. We want to make sure that they get the training and support that they need. And our jobs participants work at more than 100 employees right here in the community. So, everyone thinks, they know Goodwill as an international brand, but they don't know that it's actually a local nonprofit. There are more than 160 Goodwill regions throughout the U.S. and Canada, and each is our own autonomous region. We have our own board and our own CEO. So everything that you donate stays within our 14-county region. We don't ship anything outside, so your donations are helping people right here in your local communities.
Let's go to our callers now. Les is with us in Milwaukee. Les, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just was thinking, I used to work for the Goodwill, and I used to wash their clothes and do things there. And I just think that it would be a good idea if they would wash the clothes from people that they get in because of the COVID-19. They can create a third shift position there. And I think it will be a win-win for everyone because other people would feel safer coming in, getting the donations coming in, and the homeless or whatever people would need, because you don't have to be homeless to shop at a Goodwill. I've been shopping for Goodwill for years and years, and they're nice items and things, but people would just feel a little bit more comfortable shopping with that if everything was more sanitized. So I just thought that might be a good idea to combine those type of resources.
Les, thanks for the call. That might be something people wonder, David. The clothes that come in and then go out on the store shelves, are they washed? What happens to them between the drop-off and going on a hanger?
Well, we sort them all. And, during the pandemic, we are certainly sanitizing all of the clothes before they go out to the floor. So, Les, that was a good question. I'm glad you brought that up because it's really an important point and a very valid point. We want to make sure that everything we put out on the floor is safe for our shoppers, for our donors, and also our staff. So we make sure that those items are sanitized before they go out to the floor. Now, just because the pandemic is winding down, it doesn't mean that our safety measures are going to go away. We are still going to continue our safety measures and making sure that everything that goes out on the floor is safe before our shoppers can pick it up.
Les, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Laura now in Burlington. Laura, hi.
My question is regarding shoes. Shoes such as I've got sneakers, I've got other types of shoes, and since I don't like to throw anything in the landfill or in the waste stream, I've been saving them and saving them, and I've got so many now that are not wearable any longer. I understand Nike's got some kind of a program for shoes, but I was wondering what Goodwill would they be able to take them and, you know, recycle them into the waste stream? I mean, recycle stream somehow.
Laura, thanks for the call. I've had that quandary myself, David. Like, this pair of shoes, I'm pretty sure nobody's ever going to want to wear these again. Do you still want them?
Yeah, I think everyone has had that situation where, you know, maybe you've had a pair of shoes and they've gotten holes in them and you don't want to get them resold, or they just might be out of style. So you want to give them away, but you don't want them to go in the local landfill. But we do take those shoes, Laura. So if you want to bring them in, they also go into the recycling stream. So I know how you feel about having a bunch of shoes. I have tons of shoes myself. And when I'm done with them, they will go to a local Goodwill so they can be responsibly recycled.
Thanks a lot for that call, Laura, at 800-642-1234. Talking to David Johnson, Communications Coordinator for Goodwill of South Central Wisconsin. His and a lot of other organizations seeing lots of donations over the last year as people do pandemic clean outs, giving advice on what they can take and some things, the building materials and whatnot, that they hazardous materials that they cannot take. We heard from Juanita in De Pere, who says she shops at Goodwill. She says she's never seen advertising or info about your recycling efforts. Had she known about what they do, she would have made it a point to donate stuff for a lot longer. Is that part of the challenge, David, spreading the word?
That is always part of the challenge because, you know, everyone knows about our stores because that's what they see, but they don't see the other items that we do. So I'm glad she brought that up because we do have signs in our stores that talk about our recycling efforts and what we do in terms of being a green business. So maybe we just ought to make them a little more prominent, but I can assure her that there are signs in our stores that let customers know that we are a green business and we do recycle their items.
Thanks a lot, Juanita, for sharing that with us. David, I've been wondering, you know, people are cleaning out and donating lots of stuff. We've had stretches where, you know, you couldn't walk into the store. There's just curbside and then limited capacity. Now we're getting back to normal. But was there kind of a block up where you had so much stuff coming in and not a lot of opportunities to sell it?
Well, at the beginning of the pandemic, we did have a lot of people who were dropping stuff off and they were just dropping it off outside the stores. And the store was actually closed. So we had to actually have our managers on duty and they would check every couple of hours or so and they were pulling those things in. You know, we didn't want people picking through them. We didn't want them to become damaged by the weather. So we had to pull that stuff in. So it was a little bit of a challenge at one point, but once we sort of got into a rhythm, it was much better to handle.
We'll leave it there. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's David Johnson, Communications Coordinator for Goodwill of South Central Wisconsin. We talked to them today about a rise in donations that have come in during the pandemic and the types of things donation centers typically can and can't accept. You can get more info, by the way, linked at WPR.org/Central Time. That's WPR.org/Central Time. And let us know your best ever thrift store find. You can email us right now, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or tweet us your thrift store star. We're at Central Time WPR. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, local governments around the U.S. have experimented with the idea of a universal basic income. A founder of a universal income project joins the show to make the case for the idea and to tell us how it works and the results of some of the different experiments. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then new research shows that homes in mainly white neighborhoods in the Milwaukee metro area are worth nearly 5 times as much as homes in black-majority neighborhoods. We'll find out what has led up to that gap and some possible solutions. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.